That is a massive assumption. I don't think most people know that.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. This is Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Doug McBurney. Fred, today we welcome back to Real Science Radio, Dr. Pete Moore. And a little later in the program, we'll have another doctor from Oxford University.
Well, thank you, Doug and Fred, for having me back. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, Pete, I can't believe we have you back in studio. And we had a series last summer that was one of my favorite shows, and it was on special relativity, general relativity, you know, Einstein. And, you know, we discussed why we believe it's flawed. And then we looked at an alternative model that I had never heard of before that you've been researching for a long time, which explains relativistic effects without making time itself relative. Because here at Real Science Radio, we've always rejected the idea that time is relative. So after that series aired, we received a letter from a listener who said he'd love to hear you respond to a 2023 paper in a Journal of Creation. And that paper is titled "The Passage of Light in the Universe, Absolute or Relative Motion." So I sent that to you, Pete, and you really not only took it, you ran with it, and you even contacted the author of that paper, Dr. Clifford Denton.
That's correct.
Yeah. So that's, and guess what? We have as our special guest, Dr. Clifford Denton. Welcome to Real Science Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yes, welcome, Dr. Denton. By the way, folks, Dr. Denton began his career as a pilot in the Royal Air Force, studied mathematics at Cambridge, taught mathematics, computer studies, worked on government research at Oxford. He was awarded a PhD from Oxford. He's been in full-time Christian ministry for 43 years, supporting Bible schools, strengthening families in England who teach their kids at home. Do they do that in England, Doctor?
They do more and more with the pressures of government now.
That's fantastic. And, of course, Dr. Denton's been promoting the Creator God for the whole time. Welcome to Real Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a real privilege to be here.
Yeah, and boy, I'm impressed. You were a pilot for the Royal Air Force. That's incredible, along with being a scientist from Oxford. So here's our plan for today. We're going to do a quick recap of last summer's series with Pete. Then Dr. Denton will walk us through the central argument of his Journal of Creation article. And finally, we'll put these ideas side by side and see where they line up. And, you know, and Pete, you can comment on what you think and how it fits with, you know, the model that you presented called the Oppola model. Mm-hmm. So now let's go ahead and switch to, let's go ahead and have you go through that. Okay, so we've got a couple of slides we want to share. And for those listening on the radio, we'll explain these as we go. So, Pete, can you walk us through the very first show we did was The Case Against Einstein?
Thank you. I'd like to remind our viewers that this is an hour and 20-minute presentation that's on the internet. And so as we kind of hit the highlights, that's one thing. But people that are interested in this should look up your YouTube and then listen to the entire thing. So The Case Against Einstein, it kind of started with giving, you know, what is Einstein and why is it weird? But I think one of the most interesting things is that we covered Sir Isaac Newton's physics as a complete separate different thing from Einstein. And Sir Isaac Newton used absolute time, and he used those words, absolute space. And in his talkings, the ether is not only possible, he contemplated how it might even work. So that was interesting. But Newton did one thing for us, and that is he gave all of us scientists in the future a stern warning. And that warning was about confusing actual time with a clock measuring time. And there's two different things, time versus measured time. And he said, if you don't watch your language and you're a little sloppy in your language, you will get unusual and purely mathematical expressions. And he even went further and he said, they even do strain the sacred writings. So he looked at all of this relativity stuff as not being healthy, at least from the standpoint of biblical scripture. One of the things we looked at is that Einstein said that the light is constant with respect to the observer. But, you know, we've had space probes, and we had the Mariner that went to Mars. And then here on the screen, you see we had Pioneer and we had Voyager space probes. One of the things that happened is the radio signals coming back from these space probes showed that light was not going the same speed. Sometimes it got there too fast, as with Pioneer and Voyager, but with the Mars, at times it would come fast, and other times it would slow down. And they, what is this? That's not constant. And so all of the space probes are kind of a violation of this constancy of the speed of light.
Sounds like there's something in space.
Absolutely. Something caused, nothing couldn't have caused anything.
That's right. That's right.
So the we covered a number of falsifications of the theory of relativity. In other words, we were being critics. There's probably hundreds of these critical things. We only took a few in that video that our users can go out and look at. But, of course, speed of light variances relative to the Earth have been noted by a number, and I just mentioned the space probes. Another one was E equals MC squared. Everyone thinks that Einstein produced that, and it kicked us off into the atomic world, and that came out of relativity. But actually, Einstein did not use relativistic math. In his derivation, he actually backed the relativistic part out, and Scientific American wrote an article about that, saying, you know, when he backed it out, really, he just did it with classical physics. And of course, has also been derived by Simhoni using classical physics and the Apollo model.
Yeah, so E equals MC squared, everybody thinks that that's relativity, but it's not. It has nothing to do with it.
And they accept relativity because of E equals MC squared, and it absolutely does not apply in any way. Then you've got Mercury's perihelion. And Einstein, his math said, well, look at how accurate it is on Mercury using this relativistic stuff. The problem with that was when you look at the other planets, Venus, and you look at Jupiter and Saturn and those others and apply it, it's not very accurate there. So it looks like he picked the one that was accurate and ignored all the rest. But we also have people who have used Newtonian math. And these are creationists that have even written books about this, and they not only got the one for Mercury right, they made it actually more accurate, and it also works on the other planets, and that's using Newtonian physics. We then had another YouTube that was produced and is on the internet, and it's called Replacing Einstein's Relativity. So if you criticize Einstein, and that's all you do, the people that love Einstein say, well, you've given us a criticism. Okay, what have you got to replace Einstein with? And if you don't have anything, they will just ignore you. And that's been going on for 120 years. So we had to turn that around and say, okay, let's try to replace the Einstein theory of relativity. What do we replace it with? And of course, we were going to suggest that there's an ether and that this ether is the mechanics of that ether would actually then explain away the null result of the Michelson-Morley and other things. Now, we have, I guess you have brought up a video that was on the internet that gives you a picture of what the EPOLA looks like. I think they did this with finite element analysis and then made it to where you could visualize it.
Yeah, so we'll run that video, and while it's running, you're going to kind of explain what's going on for our radio audience. So let's take a look at that now.
What we see on the screen then is kind of a close-up of the ionic crystal of the EPOLA with electrons and positrons that are strongly adhering one to another. So there's an electrostatic attraction that's strongly holding this crystal together. So it is a crystal of electron and positron particles. Now, it's bigger than this, of course. We're just looking at a small cube of it, but it goes and fills all of outer space. So now we're looking at a unit cube, but it can get in a small particle of matter can go inside them, and it makes them swell. That can be a particle of a hydrogen nucleus or iron nucleus or uranium nucleus. So there's a particle showing how different particles will make it swell more. So if you have uranium-238, it might swell quite a bit. That's a distortion of the lattice. And here's a particle actually moving through at a constant speed of velocity, and how it is, the EPOLA is now reacting to that particle. And it actually takes energy to go through, but then the energy comes back on the backside and keeps that particle moving through space billions of miles at one velocity once it gets started. So it's perfectly elastic.
Okay. So to get to this model, Professor Simone, there was a discovery in the 1930s, correct, about shooting a laser into space.
That is correct. Dr. Anderson actually discovered the positron in 1932, and he shone a high-frequency light into a vacuum. And at a certain particular energy, out popped an electron and something new, out popped a positron. They always come out in pairs when you do this. So how in the world can you point your laser at nothing and get electron mass and positron mass that pop out? That was the indication to Simone that that's what space is made out of. When they are not moving, you can't see them, but if you can pop them out of their little homes within the crystal, you can actually see their trails in the laboratory. And that's how they discovered, and here we have a picture of it, Dr. David Anderson. He actually got a Nobel Prize in physics for the discovery of the positron. But what most people missed at that time was it was trying to tell you this is what space is made out of. We can do the same thing on a salt crystal. We can hit it with a lot less energy, and out pops a sodium atom and a chlorine atom, and you can see them. They actually get kind of fuzzy in the crystal, and you can see them. You take the laser away, and all of a sudden it goes back to clear. So when they're not moving, you can't see them, and then you can. The other thing that we looked at, and this was Sir Isaac's warning about confusing time with measured time, and what we are showing here is if you had a stopwatch and it was running, and then you just dropped it in that vat of water, would it make it slow down? Well, of course, that ticking clock would slow down. Well, then the question is, did time slow down, or did the clock slow down because it was affected by the environment? And that's the difference between Simone model. It shows that the EPOLA is causing these things, and it's not time itself slowing down.
Yeah, so that EPOLA, that visual representation we saw of this beam going through, this particle shooting through the lattice, if the lattice is more dense, it's going to go faster. If it's less dense, it's going to go slower. It's going to affect the speed of light, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
As those particles get closer together, as the EPOLA is more dense beyond Pluto, it's stiffer. And if it's stiffer, then the energy wave going through it goes faster. Now, when it's near to our sun and they're spread apart, it goes slower. Now, one of the things that Simone did, he estimated what is the spacing of these particles, because if you don't know that, you can't even start your math. So he compared it to salt crystals, ionic salt crystals, and said this pure ionic electron positron should have a spacing of a certain amount. Well, then along comes Dr. Grissom in Houston, said, you know, that salt crystal analogy, maybe it's right, but I'm going to calculate. So you just saw the equations he used in calculus to calculate it. And then here he's plugging in all of the values, and he calculates very accurately with that electrostatic attraction math and calculus then it was 4.44454 times 10 to the minus 15. Well, look what, below. That's what Simhoni had said years earlier. It was 4.4 times 10 to the minus 15. So he got it right.
So an independent look at this, they came up with the same number for the spacing in this.
That's correct. They applied a lot more science and mathematics and calculus from the standpoint, if the pola is true, then you should be able to take these particles, apply electrostatic attraction mathematics, which is known, and you should then be able to calculate those spacings.
Okay. And just for my own self, so ether, there's a controversy around ether, right? So a lot of scientists today, for some reason, still don't think there's an ether, but there's got to be something there, right? That experiment in the 30s proved it. And so are there ether deniers still, or what?
Oh, absolutely. People who particularly understands the mathematics of Einstein are so enthused with it that they don't want the ether. Because remember, when he developed all that, he said there was no ether. Now, what they don't know is in 5 years later, after the general theory came out, he reversed himself and said, no, there's got to be an ether. But they ignore that. They're still stuck with this math.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately has happened. Now, here's the thing about if there is no ether, space is nothing, then God didn't create that, because he never creates nothing. He only creates something.
That's right. And before we bring in Professor Denton, I also wanted to ask you, because at Real Science Radio, we've been talking about, you know, plasma cosmology and some of the work Barry Setterfield has done. Well, this electron positron, this is an electromagnetic force, right?
Yes.
This forms a magnetic field. So what are your thoughts on that? I don't know if I asked you that, you know, last
time. You did not. I was at a creation conference, and there was a table, and it had this thick book. And I was looking at all the books, and I picked it up and looked through it, and it had so much interesting math and physics and on zero-point energy. Mm-hmm. And I bought it. It was the most expensive book in the whole conference, and I bought it because this is it. When I looked through it, I could see he calls things differently, but there is an alter ego that's called the Apola that is saying kind of the same thing in some areas.
And this particular author was Barry Setterfield.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if he knows much about the Apola concept, but some of the things that he defines in with certain words, there's a same thing in the Apola. But now, unlike him, we've identified what the particles are that actually do this mechanism.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So before, again, we're going to get to you really soon here, Dr. Denton, sorry. I want to make one last point that you made in that last video series, because to me, this is super important. When you look at all the fathers of modern science, and you've mentioned Sir Isaac Newton, there's so many here. We're showing it on the screen for the radio audience. You can go through just a list of who's who in science. You know, Thomson, Gilbert, Robert Boyle, on and on. James Clerk, Clerk Maxwell, I'm sure people have heard of him. All of these guys were Bible-believing Christians, except at the very bottom of the list, there's somebody who isn't. He's either an atheist or an agnostic, and yet everybody accepts his stuff. He's a hero of the left. Time magazine loves him. He's been on their cover numerous times. And his name happens to be Albert Einstein.
Right. As we look at that pattern, God has granted favor and understanding to Christians and have allowed them to discover the main foundations of different branches of science. And if Einstein's theory of relativity is true science and not something that's false, then he would be the first counterexample. He would not be a Christian. That would be the only time that a new branch of science has been formed that was not a Christian.
Yep. Okay, so, and I know we've been teasing the audience, Dr. Denton, we're going to have you on really soon, but we have to get in our interesting fact of the week.
Do we have to do that? The interesting fact of the week is that atheistic science depends on the concept of nothing, which is impossible. There's no such thing as nothing. There can't be, because God has always existed, so there's always been something. Did I get it right, Fred?
You pretty much did. So, hey, you get a yeah. That was good. But wait, we have not asked the question yet. And by the way, some listeners pointed out, I had several listeners email in about our interesting fact, I think from a few shows ago. So, Doug, it turns out I asked you what letter isn't in the periodic table.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, and you guessed X, which wasn't correct, but
right.
I then said that it was J. Well, it turns out there's also another letter that was kind of in there temporarily, so I'm going to kind of give myself a little bit of a pass, but maybe not. The letter Q is not in the periodic table, so I guess I deserve this.
Okay, and I had it wrong on both counts, so I'm doubly wrong.
I'm glad you didn't ask me. I wouldn't. Yeah. I was sitting here trying to think it through, and I couldn't remember which one wasn't.
Okay, but we have the brightest audience in America anyway, and we don't know about the UK, Dr. Denton. But we're about to test that. Let's go, Fred.
Okay, but first, who is sponsoring this week's interesting fact of the
week? Oh, that's right. We want to thank the Wilsons in Wisconsin for sponsoring the interesting fact of the week. Thank you, Wilsons in Wisconsin.
All right, so here we go. The interesting fact of the week. And Doug, this is a 50-50, so your odds are getting really good for this one.
Okay.
So does sound travel faster through air or water?
Water.
That was good.
Wow. Good job, Doug. So why,
Fred? I was a sound man. Well, I'd probably need help from one of the doctors to explain why, but I knew that just because of my experience. My vast experience with radio and all of that sound.
I can explain that.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, help me.
Yeah.
By the way, it's four times, a little bit more than four times faster.
Yes. A sound, or which is an energy wave, travels through any medium based on the stiffness of that medium. So when you talk about the stiffness of air versus the stiffness of water, if you do a belly buster in the air, as you go through the air, it doesn't hurt. But when you do a belly buster on water, you'll find out it's quite stiff compared to air.
Yeah. And so this gets to the polar, right? It's more dense.
That is correct.
It's faster. Something denser, even light, will travel faster through space. Denser space.
That's correct.
And so would sound travel more quickly through steel than it would through water?
Yes, and it also travels faster through a diamond than it does steel.
All right. Well, that's very helpful.
All right. So we are finally at the part where, Dr. Denton, we'd like you to talk about the article that you had published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Creation. And so, Dr. Denton, welcome to Real Science Radio again. And finally, we can hear what you have to say about this article that you published.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's lovely to hear you all speaking. And then it comes to you, I want you to carry on speaking. But anyway, I'll try to tell you, I'll try to make it as simple as possible for those who are hearing. But we do have some visuals, of course, for the online. I want to just, before talking about the actual paper and the contents of it, I'd like to talk about a little bit about the background, because I think it is quite important. I come up with reasonable qualifications, which you kindly read out, Doug, but they're not the highest qualifications. I don't think it was my scientific background that helped. It was set a little foundation, that's all. The way this paper came about was a little group of us in England used to meet regularly on a monthly basis. We're talking back in the 1990s, I think, and we would have a little apologetics group. That was the word that was used. And the convener of that group and myself used to stay behind. I'd stay an extra night because we had this common interest about was Einstein right? And we didn't believe it was right. I studied both relativity and quantum mechanics, basically the foundations of it, at Cambridge University when I did a maths degree. But you can be beguiled by it. In fact, you know, you want to pass your exams, so you put the right answers in, and you haven't thought it through much. But then all those years later, we talked, and It's just irrational. So can we do something about it? And we would talk for hours. Now, my friend's name is Francis Pym. I want to honour him because it's not just me that's brought this particular slant. It was he and I together. Now, Francis was a pastor at the time, and he was, before that, an architect, a very good one. So he had an architectural view of the universe, and it didn't make sense to him about the elegance of God's creation and the confusion that was wrought by Einstein's attempt to get round the Michelson-Morley experiment, bringing in time as a variable alongside the three attributes of space, and we end up with space-time. And it gets all twisted up, and it doesn't seem elegant anymore, and hardly anybody understands it, and we didn't like it. So we sat and we talked and we prayed for hours. It was a strange thing. Now, Francis was more of an architect than a mathematician. I at times got a little bit frustrated with his maths. He tried to do something architecturally that you have to do a bit more precisely. But I stuck there, and I remember once he went out of the room, and I was there on my own, and it was nothing to do with the logic of anything. We would get our pencils out and we'd have paper in front of us. We'd scribble equations, we'd draw pictures, and it was just difficult to write anything coherent down. Well, who's making the measurements, this frame or that frame, the moving frame, the space-time? How can you counter it? And I was sitting there on my own, and I felt something lift from me. It was as if a weight went, a mist went, and light came straight into my mind, and I could write these equations down in my mind, as it were. Afterwards, I drove home and I wrote them down on paper. But it was as if the Lord revealed this. It was not mathematical prowess. No enough maths to deal with the equations. But it wasn't by logic, it was by revelation. That's how it seemed to come. And thereafter, it was as clear as anything, where it was just fuzzy before. We wrote a little book on this, and a few people purchased it. But it's been a long time. I've got reasonable contacts in the world of physics and maths, going right back to university. And I try to get people to read this. But they were in the same fuzz, in my opinion, or they had their own work based on what they were founded. They want to continue. I mean, it might be unkind, but, you know, if you're paid a good fee for your scientific work, why do you want to suddenly change gear? Why do you want to even read it? Why don't we want to even comment? So it's very hard to get any readership. And actually, the equations are so very simple. You can do it with very basic maths. I could do it in my head. But it's that almost fuzz that needs to disappear. And even as I go through some of this from the paper, that fuzz may be there for some. But I think, therefore, it is a spiritual matter that we're dealing with as well as a scientific one. And all I can say is that after a long time, finally, one morning, I thought, well, why don't I get in touch with somebody from Creation World who we knew and see if they'd like to promote the book that we did? Well, they didn't want to do that. But instead, they put me in touch with Journal of Creation, which is a very good magazine. It's a peer-reviewed magazine. It's got a high standing in the creation world, published in Australia now, but it's a worldwide network that they represent. And they picked it up and they put it to review. And so it came out, and this one was featured on the cover of that particular journal. So suddenly the door opened, at last it opened. And it's a long journey. And Dr. Moore knows that. He said so much about it that nobody seems to want to know. But I think it's now time to let it out. And maybe it's God's time for a group of us to come together and see this through to other areas. There's so much here. It's very basic maths, I'll show you. But there's a big world opening up here. So thank you that I can come on board. and I hope I can present it simply enough to honour both my friend, who's now deceased, my dear friend Francis Pym. He's now deceased. He's left me this bit, and I'll finish it best I can. But others need to be involved. So I hope our listeners and those who might see it online will stick with it and see it through. It's quite straightforward when you can see it, but it seems complicated at times when you don't.
Yeah, so again, this is from Creation Ministries International, and they put out the Journal of Creation, and you can get there at creation.com. How simple is that?
Hmm.
So they're friends of ours. We go through their Creation magazine about every 3 or 4 months. So yeah, let's go ahead and go through this, Dr. Denton.
Yeah. So can I start with an analogy with the speed of sound? And thank you, Dr. Moore, for putting these diagrams up, which you've used on your own YouTubes, I know. So it's good we can repeat them and not have to redraw them. But thank you for all that. If we look at how the speed, the passage of sound in the air, and we've talked about other mediums, but keep it simple, we're sending a sound signal from a generator, something that makes the sound, to a reflector, and it bounces back. If that vehicle, which is holding the transmitter and reflector, stands still, very easy, just measure distance over time and distance related to time, and you can get speed out of it, and you get some measurement of the speed of sound. What is happening is that the sound wave is dropping into the air, as it were. The air carries that sound wave until it reaches the reflector. It bounces back. The air carries it back, and it's received by the receiver. Straightforward calculations, which most school children will do in the course of their science lessons. But then if you move that vehicle, the sound is going in the air while the vehicle also moves. So you've got to make adjustment for the movement of the vehicle. And this is, we have to be careful. We use the word relativity in a different sense. This relativity is that confusing bundle of space-time equations that came from Einstein as he tried to take theories forward. Relativity in our sense is what we call Newtonian. In other words, it's based on absolutes. And nevertheless, we use it because the vehicle is moving relative to the air. Or the air is really relative to the vehicle, but it depends which way you see it. But you've got a moving car, and you've got, therefore, a sound which is still going at the same speed, but it's catching up with the car. And so you have to do a calculation based on that to take into account the movement, the velocity of the car, in addition to knowing the velocity of the sound is to be studied. It's straightforward because in relative terms, the car is moving forward relative to the air, so that in the forward direction of that sound wave, you subtract the velocity of the car from the velocity of the air to have the, as it were, the relative, in Newtonian terms, speed of the air to the car. And on the reverse, you add the velocity of the speed of the air to the speed of the car. And so it seems to come back quicker because you're moving towards it. And based on that, you can do a simple calculation that any school child will be shown how to do. You do a simple calculation and you'll find the speed of air when you know the speed of the vehicle and the length of the distance that the air is travelling, the length of the vehicle. That is how to deal with the sound. What is happening? The sound drops into the air carries the sound until it reaches reflector, bounces back, and then the air carries the waves again back to the source. And you get you can time the two-way journey of that passage of airwaves. Straightforward. And so you would expect to be able to do that with light in a similar way. Instead of having a sound wave transmitter, you would put a light transmitter in place and have a mirror at the other end so that the light bounces back from a mirror and then can be detected on a detector from where the source of the light was. You would expect to do a similar calculation of taking account of the speed of the moving vehicle compared with the speed of the light that you were trying to find. And that sort of inquiry, as we know, was going on very much and gave rise to inquiries about how does light travel? Is there an ether? Isn't there? And then the Michelson Moore experiment above everything else was showing we can't find the ether because we can't really find any difference in the speed of a light wave going in the direction of motion compared with going vertical to the motion. That was the Michelson-Morley experiment. It gave no result, and that was the launch point of Einstein. There was a sort of hold-up. Where do we go from here? Until a clever man came in, wrote a paper in 1905, and it was very persuasive. And out of it came the special theory of relativity. So just backing up for a moment, we're trying to perform an experiment rather like the sound experiment, where instead of a sound wave, a light ray passes from a transmitter to a reflector and back again, and trying to measure the time it takes for that to happen. Of course, light travels much faster, so it's not so easy to do that. But that is the basis of the experiment. Since they could not find a difference, they could not detect the ether, really, based on this, but it was related to the speed of sound, that speed of light, sorry, some assumptions had to be made. And that is where Einstein made assumptions, which already Dr. Moore has pointed to, which we believe were incorrect assumptions.
All right, this is probably a good place to pause for a moment. What Dr. Denton has just done for us is walk us through some of the background, how this question about light, motion, and the famous Michelson-Morley experiment led Einstein to introduce the idea that time itself must change. That is, time is relative. But Dr. Denton and his colleague Francis Pym weren't satisfied with that conclusion. Instead of accepting that time becomes elastic, they went back to the basic physics and asked a different question. What if the experiment can be explained without making time relative at all? And that's exactly where we're heading next. Dr. Denton is going to show us some surprisingly simple mathematics that re-examines the Michelson-Morley experiment and demonstrates that you don't actually need relative time to explain the results. So stay with us, because next week we'll continue this episode where Dr. Denton will dig into the math behind the argument and show how this alternative explanation works.